Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Shelton School Podcast. I am upper school film teacher Hunter Dusing, and joining me is middle school teacher Courtney Dios.
Hello.
Hello. And our guest today is humorist, movie actor, commercial pilot, real estate developer, stockbroker, co-host of America's first ever television stock market program, and author of several books, including How Dyslexic Benny Became a Star, Joe Griffith.
Hey.
How's it going?
So far, so good.
That is quite a CV you've got there. And I'm particularly interested in the book How Dyslexic Benny Became a Star.
Well, it's interesting. We're at Shelton School because 20 years ago I was at Shelton when it was down off of Lover's Lane. Mm-hmm. And I was in the library because I was doing research on who runs this business and all that kind of stuff. So I was in the library, and students would come in and sit around a table, and the librarian would read to them, and they'd turn the page when she turned the page. Mm-hmm. And after they left, another group came in, and then those three people left, and another group came in, and they all left. And after they left, I said, excuse me, I thought you all taught them to read instead of reading to them. And she said, well, this is part of the process. I said, well, what book would you like to have to read to them you don't have? And she said, a book where they can see somebody like themselves succeeding. I got up and left, went to a barbecue restaurant on Lover's Lane, pulled out those big, huge napkins they have and started writing notes, left, went home, and spent 4.5 hours in front of my computer, and I wrote the book.
Wow.
Okay.
Because I knew the story.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
I knew what was going on with them, and it just came out of me. I didn't think of what I'm going to say next. I knew how I was going to start it by the time I got home, and it just came out of me. Actually, it probably been there my whole life.
Well, and so when you were young, they probably didn't exactly know what dyslexia was.
Well, I think that's pretty fair.
Yeah.
They didn't even know what a space shuttle was when I was young.
I think Jules Verne had thought about it.
We didn't have a TV until I was 7, and we didn't have an air conditioner in our car until I was 14. Yeah, I think you could say that.
So when did you find out that you were dyslexic?
I was 42 years old. I saw an article in the Dallas News, if I remember, and it had the word dyslexia and something about reading, and I said, that sounds a lot like me. And then I asked a friend of mine who happened to work at the medical school, can you find out about this? He called me back a week later. They don't know anything about it. So I said, okay. So then about 4 or 5 years later, I married a lady who had a son being held back in first grade. And I said, well, what good does it do to hold them back? They never held me back, or I'd still be in first grade. And so wouldn't it be something my stepson and I in the same grade? And that's got to offer hope. And they said, well, we're going to remediate, and we have a language therapist. I said, a what? And that's when I found out they can do something for them. And that changed my life. And a friend of mine wanted to be a speaker. He'd seen an article in the Dallas paper about me, and we got to be friends. And he happened to say, well, my wife just got her Ph.D., I said, really, what's it in? Language therapy. I said, well, what do you do with that? And she told me, and I go, oh, my gosh, that changed my whole world. And my stepson, when he was in the first grade, they had a language therapist there, mm-hmm. and that's when I found out they could help him. Those were two very important moments in my life as far as what I could do to try to change this system.
Yeah, absolutely. So what it was the hardest part of school when you were growing up?
Showing up.
I can see that.
Yeah, showing up was hard. Remember, I didn't know what this was.
Right.
And in the first, second, and third grade, in the third grade, I remember we did addition and subtraction, which was up and down the paper. In the fourth grade, we went to division, which was sideways, and I've been lost ever since.
That's a pretty fair.
It was just like there was this one moment. I said, well, I was doing great up and down. You know, but not sideways, and I never understood math since.
I still don't. I think
I might have had a similar experience.
Yeah, I'm not crazy. I mean, no one really understood learning differences back then. I mean, I think all of us and our parents had similar, if they had what now is diagnosed as a learning different, had a similar experience. And I mean, it really played a very negative role in their life back then. And so, I mean, I know showing up was hard for you, but how, like, if we could go back from age 42 before, just what your experience was, just not only in school, but in life after school. And
you mean after school while I was in school or after I got out of school?
Yeah, so kind of playing your experience through school and how you got through school with kind of the experiences of, like, how'd you get through and how did you have to push through?
I could get
what were some survival strategies?
Yeah,
oh,
because
my gosh.
Some
of them I don't want people to know what they were.
Well, because I almost feel like back then you had to make something work to get through.
Here's the way. This is a child's mind. But I, looking back, this had to be what was going through my mind. They win, I lose. Mm-hmm. I had to win so they would lose. I saw in my little childhood mind that was what's going on here. I didn't know everybody else wasn't doing it at that point. I just knew what was going on with me. And when I got up in high school, we had algebra and stuff like that, and I would leave. And I'd go home. I lived a block from the school. And then another block past there, there was a retired algebra teacher. And I'd go spend an hour with her doing the same thing I couldn't do earlier in the day at the school.
Yep.
So it was just a reinforcement that this is not anything I want to do.
Yeah.
So everybody else is playing. I'm being tutored.
Mm.
And the tutoring didn't do anything for me because it was just, she was teaching me the same way they were teaching me at school. And it's just, it was redundancy.
Mm. Yeah. Well, and it's so crazy because I know that a lot of kids we've talked to this point, they always felt very different, like coming from, and this is like now, knowing what it is, they leave their current past situation, I guess, and they, one of the things they say is, I knew I was different. Everyone would always look at me and say, why can't you read? Why aren't you where we are? And I feel like talking to people who had this experience when no one knew what a learning difference was, something that they talk about.
No, that never happened to me.
Yeah, and that's very interesting. So that's where it's like you didn't know you were different. You just knew you couldn't read and things were hard for you.
I struggled in everything.
Yeah.
I remember when I was in the sixth grade or seventh grade, they had you, and, you know, you were lined up in your rows in your desk, and the teacher would have you as the first person to read paragraph one. So I'm counting the people, and I'm going down to the paragraph I need to be working on before they get to me. And sure enough, I didn't do much better, but I'm always looking ahead how to solve this problem. Well, there was a kid, like the fourth guy down, and he's had a radio voice, and he just read beautifully. And he had glasses. I said, that's what I need to do. So I go home, and I learned a very valuable business lesson. If you go to an optometrist to buy glasses, they're going to sell them to you, even if you don't need them. And so I still couldn't read, so I said, that's not what it is.
Oh, I now that I think about it, when you said that, that jogged my memory, because I remember – now being in school and doing the math as to when I was going to be called on and going, all right, you know, are there any words I don't know here? going, looking ahead to the paragraph I was going to have to read and sort of anticipating it and
I
was going to do. Yeah, now I remember doing that. I hadn't
really thought about that
in forever.
Let me point out something to you. I don't know if it's this way today, but if you passed Algebra 1, you got to take Algebra 2. And if you pass Latin 1, you get to take Latin 2.
Yes.
So what was my reward for doing all this?
Because it just got harder.
It just got worse.
Yeah.
True story. Now, I grew up in a small town. And in Latin one day, I raised my hand, and Mrs. Letterman taught algebra and Latin.
Mm.
And she said, oh, Joe is so interested all of a sudden, and she was so excited and animated. What? And I said, what are the chances of someone coming through this town from Latin and wanting to talk to me? Of course, all my classmates just roared, and she rolled her eyes. I was dead serious. Why am I having to do this? That's what I was asking. What's in it for me?
Right.
I'll get them to go talk to somebody else if I don't understand them. So these were the little things that were going on in my mind. Because, you know, you were just trying to find out, what's this all about? What's in it for me? I'll tell you the plus of all this. I learned early on how to work around your problems.
Mm.
Every business venture, everything we do in life, there's a problem. Even an airline pilot has to go around a thunderstorm.
Mm-hmm.
He sees the problem, he knows how to get around it. You kind of learn that without knowing you're learning it.
Mm-hmm. No, I was talking to Courtney earlier, and I was telling her this story the other day. I was talking to my dad. And
is that the first time you've
yes.
talked to him in a while?
Yeah. No.
You're like this is a major
I
event.
Said,
here,
I said this was a big deal. I said, Dad, you should be very privileged to that. Feel very privileged that you get to speak to me. No, I'm right. just kidding. But no, he had trouble in school, and I was talking to him because there are members of our family who are chronically late. And he's never been that way. And I said, Dad, why are you, you're so punctual. Why is that? And he goes, well, when I was in school, if I was late to class, I got called on. He goes, it drew attention to me. So the way I avoided that was by flying under the radar as much as possible. And part of that was being on time to class.
And your dad's dyslexic.
Yeah.
Too. So, I mean, but I think that, you know, it's a good point to make because you never wanted to draw attention when you knew you were struggling. Mm-hmm. And so
I tell you how I got him to quit calling on me. Steve Allen had a program and on Sunday nights, which was comedy and comedians, and he had a segment he did every Sunday night where there were four people who just walking down the street and they interviewed him. One of them was Don Knotts and three other funny people. And one guy's name was, I can't think of his name right now, but they said, sir, can I ask you a question? And his response was, why not? So I go to school. And the teacher said, Joe, would you do this? I'd go, why not? And what I was doing looking back, I'm trying to get him, don't call on me. It ain't worth it.
That's awesome.
Not worth it.
It's not worth it.
I'm trying to discourage him from calling on me. Of course, everybody in the class laughed.
Yeah. But
what did I wind up doing?
You winded up trying to make the class laugh.
And I became a comedian.
Yes.
We've laughed this much.
I know.
I found out something just recently about comedians, and I said, that's true. They don't have many close friends. And the reason is, you're not part of the group.
Mm.
And as a dyslexic, back then, I was not a part of the group. They were all having fun. I'm being tutored.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't develop those instincts of being a group person. As a comic, you're standing in front of a convention or a corporate meeting, whatever it is, you're up here, they're all down there.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just not part of it.
Yeah.
You're the reason they're there. Without you, they don't have a meeting. So you're important to be there, but you're not part of it. I was very comfortable with that because I was never really part of anything growing up. I was too different in many other ways. So these are things that I look back and find out, I knew I could make people laugh. I did it in class. So I always was fascinated by comedians on television. And I remember I had a date when I was like a junior in high school, drove to Dallas to see Bob Hope at SMU.
Mm.
Mr. Big.
Yeah.
The top dog. We're in the car driving home, and she said, "You didn't seem to be having a very good time." I said, "Well, why? I had a wonderful time. Why did you say? Well, you weren't laughing like everybody." I said, "But I was getting more out of it than y'all were. I was studying. How did he know that was funny?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How did he know this? Why did that work?" And when I got out of high school, my brother and I were sent to New York. I don't know if it'd get us out of town or something, but I went to a show called Who Do You Trust? And the host, it was a game show, a daytime game show. The host was a guy that nobody had ever heard of named Johnny Carson.
Mm.
I'm sitting in the studio audience. It's live. And he said something, and I hollered out something. I don't remember what it was. I wasn't trying to agitate him or cause a problem. I wanted to find out what he would do when somebody did that.
Yeah.
So I would someday know what to do. Mm-hmm. So I always knew what I wanted to do. I didn't know how to get there
mm-hmm.
until years later. So all this turned out to be a foreshadowing of where I was going.
Mm-hmm.
But how was I to, you know, it was, like I said, you can walk down the road with shoes on or without them. The kids today get to wear the shoes. I didn't have the shoes. I didn't get remediated. Mm-hmm. I didn't have anybody helping me. I just had to do it all the hard way.
So you said you didn't know, you knew what you wanted to do, but you didn't know how to get there.
I knew what I loved to do, but from a small town in the 50s.
Yeah.
Television had just barely come in. It was mm-hmm. black and white. We'd had somebody on the roof adjusting the antenna every time it got mm-hmm. windy. That's kind of how crude it was.
Yeah.
Every Sunday night, I was in front of that TV looking at comedians.
Mm-hmm.
They fascinated me.
Yeah.
And I wound up being one. I think I was fascinated maybe because they helped me forget my problems for a few minutes.
Oh, sure.
But that's so interesting because, like, even looking back, I mean, and I'm much younger, but so in the 90s when I was going through school, and learning difference really wasn't a thing then either. No one really knew a whole lot about it, but I remember always studying people who were funny because I knew that in school I was struggling, mm-hmm. but I knew if I could make people laugh,
yeah.
that's what people would know me as. They wouldn't know me as the person that would always be told, why can't you do this? Mm-hmm. And are you cheating on tests because you can do great on homework, but you can't take tests? Which, that's two totally different extremes. Like, homework, you've mm-hmm. got the material. Test, you've got to regurgitate the material.
Right.
And so, just looking back on that, it's just so interesting because I think one of our coping mechanisms is humor.
Oh, sure.
And we are intelligent people, but we just don't know why we can't do the things that seem so easy to people. But it's like the strategies,
mm-hmm.
we become almost more successful. I can't really say we become more successful, but we learn the tools of problem solving and how to get around problems to become what we want to become. I don't know if I'm
well. No, I understand sense. What
well,
you're saying.
Well, yeah. Let me add, that leads into what I wanted to ask you, which was, you know, you said years later you figured out how to get there. What was it that sort of pushed you in that direction where you were able to figure it out, as
okay.
you said?
Interesting. My dad made me, when I was 17 years old, take a Dale Carnegie class. So I lost the fear of speaking. Mm. He made my brother do the same thing, who's 5 years older.
So that's a public speaking course?
Yes.
Okay.
It was the cream de la cream of those days.
Okay.
So I lost my fear of speaking. So I entered a talent show in junior college as a comic, and I won it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the quality of the competition I had, not necessarily.
Well, and
my
you
talent.
Brought up you. There were 20 entries.
Yeah.
I did my studying, and you all the other entries
were music.
Were music, and he was the only comedian.
And that's why I won. I didn't want to admit it at the time, but looking back, that's why I won. I was different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was judged by an applause meter. And when they said, our last contestant awesome. Is a comedian, they started screaming before I ever walked out of there. I said, this is the easiest job in the world. How do you get paid for this? Not really.
But that's such a great point because you stood out from everyone else, and I feel like that's kids.
Yes.
Sorry. All of a sudden, in that junior college, I was big man on campus. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew me. I got quoted in the monthly newsletter of the campus of things that I never said, but if it was funny, they put my name on it because yeah. and And so that was the first time I won a talent show. So then they would ask me to MC this and MC that, and I did. So I did all kinds of stuff. MC'd a band tour for all the small towns around the Dallas-Fort Worth mm-hmm. area, doing comedy to introduce all the band and everything. So I was just doing it for fun.
Yeah.
And then when I got in the Navy, I entered a talent show and won that. I said, this is 2 out of 2.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm the only comic in both of them. I still hadn't figured out I was not an awesome talent yet. And so when I got out of the Navy, I came back and I was going to be a stockbroker because I was discharged in Long Beach, California. And there wasn't some agent standing there with a big cigar in his mouth saying, aren't you Joe Griffith? Come on to Hollywood. It's just up the road. So I drove home and went around and looked for jobs. I majored in finance. And I got a job as a stockbroker. By the fifth firm that I interviewed with, the other four never called me back because there was a little test they had. And they never would return my calls after I took that test. But they were enthusiastic about me before I took that test. I go to the last firm. They didn't have the test. And they hired me. 4 months into my 6-month training program, the boss called me. We got this little test we want you to do. Boy, I knew what it was. It has to be that same test. And I said, can I do it next week? I'm right in the middle of something. I wasn't in the middle of anything. I was trying to work out a strategy. So my strategy was, if I flunk it, I'll finish my 2 months left on my training and they won't have to pay me. Mm-hmm. Well, I flunked it. But I found out why I flunked it. It told people I would never pass the exam to get my license.
Huh. That's interesting.
So, see, it was there, and I didn't know it was there. But so that's just another example of how they were telling me, you don't measure up. You don't measure up. So I was a stockbroker for 5 years. I was mediocre at it. It was a different game back then than it is today.
Mm-hmm.
You could be mediocre and be okay because I was around a lot of smart people, and they were kind of tutoring me. I wouldn't ever do anything without saying, you know, what do you think about this? And they said, well, I wouldn't do it for that. I go, okay, so that's how I learned things. I was about to be 30 years old, and a man was opening an account with me. And he'd spent 40 years working for the same big national company. I said, that's great working the same place for 40 years. He said, not really. I said, what do you mean, not really? He said, I never did what I always wanted to do. And here he is, 65 years old, admitting I didn't have the life I wish I'd have had.
Mm-hmm.
That scared me to death. I was engaged to be married. I said, we got to break this off because I don't want anybody telling me don't do this. If it fails, I'm going to be the only one that suffers. So I left to go be a comedian. And everybody, my boss laughed at me. He said, you're going to be a comedian? I said, see, I'm funny. It's not. I'm proud to say. About 3 years later, they hired me to come talk to the Christmas party, and they paid me. So that's kind of what was going on. It was always people saying you can't. My family said you're crazy. Everybody thought I was crazy, but I had to find out, or yep. I would have been that guy when I'm 65 wishing I'd have done something else.
Yep.
And so I started going out. I didn't know anything about it. And the comedy, the nightclub show you saw, that was after about my third or fourth year learning to do this. And I hired a lady who was a writer. I met her out at the Comedy Store in California. This is when Jay Leno and Letterman and Seinfeld, all these kids were all getting started. They were about 10 years younger than I was. And they stayed, I'm not saying those names did this, but they were all staying up till 4 o'clock in the morning smoking cocaine and stuff like that. And I said, this is not my lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
So I came back. But while I was out there, I met a lady named Kathy Green. And Kathy Green was a freelance writer. She was kind of on staff with Bob Hope, who always had about 5 or 6 people on staff. But she could write for other people. So I would buy jokes from her for $5. And I found out that I could say, look, I have an idea for a routine. I could come up with stuff. She would come up with stuff. And we put them together, and it was a pretty nice routine. And a lot of that stuff you heard in that nightclub show you saw was about 4 years into my career. So I was about maybe 34 at that time. So I learned that she showed me that you can get material on how all this worked. And I wasn't ashamed to do it people say, you know, aren't you funny enough to come up with your own stuff? I said, some great actor on Broadway didn't write the play.
Yeah.
But she talked, what a great actor it is. You're the one that's delivering the show.
Yeah, a lot of comics have writers and stuff like that.
If you're smart.
Yeah.
If you're smart. And so this gal said, look, I'm going to start writing sitcoms, so I'm going to quit writing jokes, even for Bob Hope.
Hmm.
And so we got to be pretty good friends, but we lost touch. Years and later, 30-something years later, a guy called me. Someone said he got my name from another speaker, said, you need to talk to Joe Griffith, because he used to be Bob Hope's head writer. And he was also wrote for The Cosby Show, Carol Burnett. I mean, he was a big-time guy. And he wanted to go out on the circuit and talk about this. You know, thought people would be interested behind the scenes, which they always are. So I got to know him. And I was calling him. I'm coming out to California. I said, did you ever know Kathy Green, the girl that first wrote for me? Yeah, we worked together on Carol Burnett and this and that and everything. I said, you know what happened to her? No, I don't have any idea. So I got on Google or Facebook, and I found her. And she'd been on Facebook for a week. She was a big time. She wrote Married with Children.
Oh, wow.
That was her creation. She dropped me for that.
Seriously.
I've questioned her integrity for all these years. So I went out, and we had the three of us had they lived about a mile from each other and didn't know it. So the three of us got together for lunch a couple years ago, and it went on for 4 hours, and it was just a joy. I never thanked her for what she taught me, and she didn't know if I made it, even though I knew she made it, and it was a neat circle to close.
Yeah. Well, because I know you had mentioned something about, and this just kind of goes along with that, is people have kind of come into your life at the right point and the right time and given you the advice that have pushed you in the, not necessarily in the right direction, but have taught you something that made you go, I'm not going to give up. And so.
And I came close to giving up several times.
Well, and I think we all do. And I really think the advice, I always try and tell kids, if you just kind of open your ears and close your mouth and listen to people who have been through, mm-hmm. you know, whatever their experiences are, what you can learn from other people is so important. And I think
it makes the road easier.
Absolutely.
I had a guy that I met in Washington, D.C. Still trying to learn the business, and he worked for Texas Power and Light. His job was to go around and speak on community development, chambers mm-hmm. of commerce and Lions clubs and whatever. And he gave me his card and said, call me when you get back to Dallas, I'll take you to lunch. So we went to lunch, and he said, look, there are times when people ask me to go speak, and they got a little money, and I'm going to tell them I'm booked that they ought to call you. I mean, they might have had $50. Hey, that's a raise.
Right, right, yeah.
And so people like that reached out, and then he drove me over to Longview, Texas, to meet the guy that ran the East Texas Chamber of Commerce Association, which means all the chamber managers belong to his group. Every one of them hire a speaker once a year. So he got me in front of them, and then I started getting these speeches. And then somebody hear you there, and I just get better and better, and then I was buying more material and working on stuff myself. And all of a sudden it just one guy said, you know, I know an agent that's looking for a humorist, and he doesn't have one. And it was an agent out of Kansas City. And so he started me off, and he got my price up considerably, and he was sending me all over the country. Just all of a sudden this guy showed up. I was what he wanted. He was what I wanted.
Yeah.
And so it just kind of took off from that.
Well, and I believe you've given over 3,000 speeches.
Yeah.
And you were also one of the youngest inductees in the National Speaker Hall of Fame in 1981.
That was on my 40th birthday.
With a very well-known person, with Ronald Reagan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which
that was cool.
Minor celebrity, Ronald Reagan.
Yeah. I don't know whatever happened to him.
Yeah.
But,
Right.
He was in a few movies.
Oh, he was?
Yeah.
I never knew.
I don't know.
I didn't know what he did.
I don't know what he might have gone on to do something.
Yeah.
I kept wondering, why did he get this, you know? I never heard him speak.
But I just feel like in all, not knowing really your pivot point at 42 when you kind of, the word dyslexia came into your life And that probably opened up a lot of why you struggled in school and why things might have come harder to you. But I guess because you, when we were on the phone the other day, you said something to me that just really kind of, I guess I wrote it down just because it kind of hit me in a way that I was like, God, I mean, I feel like a lot of people feel this way. But you said most people chase success and you were running from failure. But in your story as a whole, you're very successful. And so kind of looking back, just kind of in a summary of your life and where you've been, even with your struggles, I mean, what would you want to give advice to someone who maybe has dyslexia or even just anyone in general that might be struggling, like what you would want to give to them to carry with them through
their
life?
Okay, that's easy. There's a reason why you're a dyslexic. There's a benefit to everything. Mm-hmm. Being born into a wealthy family is a benefit. Mm-hmm. Sometimes being born into a poor family can be a benefit. It's a motivator. Mm-hmm. So we're all motivated by different things, but yet the secret for me was the fact that I learned to speak. And the Dallas Press Club had a gridiron show. This was in 1970, I think it was. And a guy asked me to MC it. Now, all these TV personalities who usually MC it were not asked to MC it. But I said, sure, I'll MC it. And I was supposed to open up the... Now, there's 1,000 people out there paid $1,000 or whatever. I'm supposed to talk to the mayor at that time, which was Eric Johnson, not the one we have now, the one we had back then, and a big screen up there, and I turned around to talk to him, and nothing happened. The screen didn't come on. And everybody, you know, I'm looking around, everybody could tell something was going on, and I looked out the audience. I said, if Mayor Johnson were here tonight, and they just fell out in the floor. they knew... See, I think I learned that in school, how to get out of a jam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Crack a joke.
Yeah.
And a lady came up to me afterwards named Kim Dawson. And she said, who represents you? For what? I don't know. I don't need a representative. I'm a stockbroker. And she's the one that got me on the television show, the first ever stock market program, which started in Dallas. She got me in those commercials. All that was from being able to stand up in front of people and speak. Everything went from that. My daddy's wisdom of telling me to learn that. I will also add, as I got further in my career speaking and got better known, people started calling my office wanting to know, I want to be a speaker. I've always wanted to be a speaker. I said, well, I've always wanted to be president of the United States, but it's not going to happen. I found something I love to do, mm-hmm. and it's not work.
Mm. Yep.
I did it for nothing. My biggest fear of speaking was they would find out I'd do this for nothing. You find something you love to do, and people will love to pay you to do it someday.
Yep. And I don't want to like drag this on, but I think one of the things that when I was listening to one of your other speeches at the Texas A&M Commerce, you gave those students you were speaking to, you talked about if you were dealt four aces in life, what they would be. So I just want you to kind of, I think this is a good way to kind of close this up, is just advice that these four aces, the A-C-E-S,
right.
of what, because I think it really goes along with, if you have these four things in life, mm-hmm. you'll be successful. So I just kind of want you okay. to tell that.
I'll tell you the biggest lesson I learned in life was a lot of my friends were motivational speakers. And one of them invited me to his weekend seminar. So I went, and we had to set goals. We'd break into a partnership with one of the other members in the class, and we had an hour to go outside and write down our goals. So I said, well, I don't have a, you know, thing. And I was already a successful speaker by then. And I said, you know, I've always wanted to meet Red Skelton. He was my hero growing up, and I learned a lot from watching him. And she said, well, write it down. So I wrote it down. I want to meet Red Skelton. Well, what's your time frame? 6 months. 6 months? I thought you wanted to meet the guy. So I said, okay, 90 days. 90 days? Okay, 60? She let me get away with 60 days. So I come back to Dallas. Remember, I wrote down I wanted to meet Red Skelton, my childhood hero, in 60 days. So I went to eat lunch when I got back with my secretary and some other people. And the waiter was from Indiana, and that's where Red Skelton was from. And I said, well, I always wanted to meet one of the guys from there, Red Skelton. Oh, really? He said, I always wanted to meet him too. Well, he gave me the name of somebody. And so I'm speaking to a big group in Indianapolis, Indiana. Now, remember, I had written this down. It owns you when you write it down.
Yep.
It owns you. I'm up there getting ready to speak to all these people. These are the mayors and city managers of every town in Indiana. I said, is the mayor of Muncie, Indiana here? That's where Red was going to be appearing in October. He showed me where he was. I went over to his table, and I said, Red Skelton's coming for homecoming at Ball State, and I want to meet him if I come. Can you arrange that? He said, let me hear you talk first.
No pressure.
No.
Oh, jinx.
Yeah. So he arranged. He liked it, came up. Here's my card. I couldn't vote for the guy. I couldn't do anything for him. You ask people to help you, and they will.
Yep.
I met Red Skelton within 30 days of writing it down.
Yep.
Had I not written it down, I would have never said, is the mayor of Muncie here? Because I wouldn't even known he was going to Muncie.
Yep.
The most important thing you can do is write down what you want, talk it over with somebody, get it concrete, write it down, and give yourself a time frame, and it will happen.
Yep. So your four aces, what are they?
Okay. Attitude.
Yep.
If you got a good attitude, I mean, I had to develop a good attitude after being a dyslexic. I can either feel sorry for myself. Mm-hmm. Let me interrupt just a second where I was going. You notice I was successful in a way that everybody would know it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
I was on television. I did commercials. I was stand-up. And every time I did something, it was written up in the paper, my hometown. Hometown boy did good. I wanted everybody to know you were wrong about me.
That's so interesting. Because I kind of sometimes feel the same way, too, because I was always told I couldn't do it. You'll never do it. But that was kind of my motivator.
And I went to a reunion, and I couldn't get people to leave me alone.
So you're now part of the group.
Yeah. Actually,
good job.
When I was getting ready to retire, they asked me to come down and talk to the Lions Club, and a friend of mine I grew up with was there. I said, okay, I'll come down. And I'm not going to charge anything. I'll just come down. I'm dying out on this business. And, they couldn't get enough people into place.
Wow.
They all had heard about me, but they never heard me. And I said, we should have done a fundraiser this deal.
Yeah.
Well, it pleased me that people I'd known all my life were proud of me.
Yeah.
And I got verification of that.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Okay, so that's the attitude.
Yep.
C is commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you write it down. You don't write it down, it's not going to happen.
Yep.
I've heard people talk about that. Like doing journaling and stuff and just writing down what you want out of a day, what you're going to do that day, and that putting those words out there
that
forms reality.
You got to have the end goal.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And if you write down, I tell people, I'm going to shave, I'm going to brush my teeth, I'm going to eat breakfast, all the things you're going to do tomorrow, write them down. And when you check them off at the end of the day, boy, I had a good day.
Yep.
Yeah.
You can do the same thing without writing it down and go to bed. you know.
But I think having a plan creates a better attitude because when you feel successful within the day, you almost it's kind of that power of positivity.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
You feel successful.
And you want to do it again tomorrow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause
but if you don't write a list down, there's not a sense of accomplishment.
Yep. Or a goal.
Yeah.
And it won't happen.
Well, on a daily basis. You don't necessarily need a
goal. Right.
Just you get a sense of achievement, which creates another sense of achievement.
Correct.
And you want to do it over and over. That's like the you know, the first time you kiss a girl, I think I want to do that again. You know? So if you have this list and you go down and you check it and everything and it gives you a good feeling,
yeah.
you go to bed feeling, I had a great day. I really used this day.
Yeah.
Well, I think you focus more on the positive instead of the negative, too.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes. So A-C-E, enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. People will be no more enthusiastic about what you want if you're not. They will be enthusiastic only if you're enthusiastic. If you go somewhere where the clerk's working behind the counter, you know they hate their job. You know they don't. They wish you hadn't showed up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then you get to some place where they're just excited you're showing up. Same kind of job, same pay scale. It's all about the attitude and the enthusiasm.
Yeah.
If you're not enthusiastic about what you do, nobody else will be.
Yep.
S, A-C-E-S. S is service. If you're doing something to benefit other people, which I was, let me stop a second and give you a particular story. I didn't catch this early on in my career. I'm in Roanoke, Virginia. There are about 800 people in the audience at a Chamber of Commerce. About a week or so later, I get a handwritten note from a lady from Roanoke saying, my husband died 2 months ago. I was diagnosed with cancer a month ago. My neighbors insisted I come to your banquet and listen to you.
Wow.
That's the first time I've laughed in almost 3 months. Thank you. Right then, I understood the rest of my career.
Yep.
That person or someone like them is sitting in that audience, and I'm talking to them.
Yep.
And so that's the service part of it. But I got a lot of troubles growing up, emotional troubles. You know, comics don't have any close friends. You hear old Johnny Carson didn't have any close friends. Most and friends of mine that work for Bob Hope, he didn't have any friends. There's just something about what we do. All of us had a bad childhood in one manner or another. So when you see a comedian, somebody messed him up somewhere, or messed her up somewhere. And that's where the laughter comes from the pain. And you can turn it into pain, and it becomes a positive.
Yeah, it's experience.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you even talked about in that speech that I listened to and made, and it just kind of made sense to me is, you know, you talk about Steve Jobs. He's not going out asking what people need in a phone. He's creating something because he knows what people need, and he does it.
Yeah.
And people, that's why people buy it. And that's such a good point. Like, it's the innovation of just understanding and knowing what the needs are and meeting those needs.
Right.
Because if you meet them after the fact, you're behind.
Here's the deal. When you're speaking, this is another shocking point to me. When I was beginning to meet the guys that were the big shots in the business, usually one guy was a retired dentist. He sold his dental practice. He could make more money speaking and making people laugh. Another guy was a lawyer. And they all kind of got away from what they'd been trained to do what they enjoyed doing.
Right.
They told me I was the first person that they ever met that got into speaking on purpose.
That's so interesting.
I said, I'm glad I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Right.
Sometimes being dumb is good. I look back and I say, you know, one guy was, say, a preacher, and they asked him to speak at the Chamber of Commerce because he could MC it. He knew how to speak. Mm. That's kind of who was doing this stuff. And they were getting $50, $100, doing it for free. And when these old guys found out what guys like me started making, they didn't believe us.
Yeah.
Until you showed them one of the checks. And then they say, well, I shouldn't be doing $100 anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and it went to people who watched you would be stunned if they knew what you were getting paid.
Yeah. But I think the difference in you is you never worried about what you got paid. You did it because you loved it. And I think that's the key. And
I got paid because I did something I loved to do for nothing.
Yeah.
The rewards come.
And I saw a documentary on Bill Gates and on I think it was on Netflix. It was a 3-part documentary. So fascinating. Just about how he just came up with it, dropped out of college. You know, Steve Jobs dropped out of college, and so many successful people just got an idea. It's all about, I'm going to do this. But if you don't write it down, someone can talk you out of it.
Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. Well, you go back to all those success stories and you listen to what they went through, or, you know, that they didn't finish college, or that, you know, they just had an idea and at one point they believed in themselves. No one else maybe did, but they believed in their ability to do something because they knew they were good at it. And a lot of the motivation comes from, I'm going to prove you wrong.
That was a lot of, I wanted to prove everybody wrong about me. I knew what they thought.
Yeah. I mean, that was
me. They didn't say it, but I knew what they were thinking. This kid can't cut it.
Yeah.
And so it was a motivation for me.
Yeah. And I think that's for a lot of people who deal with, you know, a learning difference or, you know, just struggles, period, is you almost want to show people that they're wrong.
And that's a plus.
And that's a plus. And that's a positive. That's a plus. Mm-hmm. And going, because at the point for me, because going to Shelton for high school, and I was going to college going, sweet, all I care about is untimed tests. They've got, you know, I'll go to the school and say, you know, here's my testing. I need accommodations. We got the testing. I didn't hear from them. And I showed up 3 weeks later in the same building. I'm like, hey, I haven't heard from y'all. Did you lose my phone number? Like, I need these untimed tests. That's the only way. I just need time to read. I can't be rushed. And they were like, well, your scores are too high for us to give you the accommodations in our state. And I was like, what? I was like, no. Like, can we like do something? Because I need the untimed test. And I think at that point, when I turned around and walked out, I finally believed in myself and said, you know what? I can do this. Mm-hmm. And so that's all I needed. And that was my turning point. And when I really wanted to prove people wrong and say, you know what? I can totally do this.
Right.
Look how many free agents make it in the NFL. How many football players were not drafted by the NFL.
Right.
But came in as a free agent because they believed in themselves.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they want a job, and some of them become all pro. Mm-hmm. And then some people get drafted high, don't make it, don't last long. Mm-hmm. It's all about who you are inside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's
And sometimes the fact that they, you know, it's like being a dyslexic student. They told me I couldn't do this. I'm going to prove them wrong.
Right.
Yeah. Or you're going to let them define you the rest of your life, and you do not want to do that.
Right.
You don't want
to. That's not fair. Not fair to you or them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like somebody robbing a bank. You see them coming, don't open the door.
Right. I know. Well, and I mean, that's just such a good point. I think even just kind of the kids here, like, you know, they have a bad experience before they get to Shelton. Some start earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But at that same time, it's giving them the hope and going, you know what? We're just building tools for your toolbox.
Mm-hmm.
And once they can see their potential, these kids are unstoppable. They're intelligent kids. Most kids with learning differences are intelligent, mm-hmm. because they know how to think different. And they're the ones that later on become successful, because that's who people are looking for nowadays, mm-hmm. are people that can just think different.
Yeah. They develop those strategies that help them navigate outside of the box.
Yeah.
I almost left out the most important moment. I'm at my grandmother's house. I think I'm probably 10, 12 years old. And she said, as all grandmothers must do, what do you want to be, Joe, when you grow up? And I blurted out, I want to be an actor. And she said, you'd be a very good actor. You're very talented. What did I succeed at in life? Basically acting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only time somebody told me what I could be. Years later, she was in a nursing home in Houston. She lived to be 100 and something, and 103, I think. And my mother outlived her. She was 104. I'd go see her every time I had a speech down there, which, you know, maybe 4 or 5 times a year. I'd fly down. I'd always have the cab driver take me to that nursing home. You stay right here. I'm going to go upstairs, see my grandmother, leave the meter running. I come back down, and one guy had the meter turned off. I said, I told you to leave the meter running. I ain't charging nobody goes to see their grandmother.
No.
No.
I said, well,
that's awesome.
I need to go see her. I can never thank her enough. So I had a lot of parents who contact me because someone gives them my name. Talk to this guy about what your kid's going through and stuff. And I said, you need to reinforce. Oh, I reinforce them all the time about everything. I said, no, that's not what I'm saying. Find out what they want to be and reinforce that. Now, that's a realistic dream. You just told them what they're thinking is real.
Yeah.
But say, oh, you'll be successful. Mm-hmm. That goes kind of in one ear and out the other, yep. I think.
Yeah.
But she was so specific. What do you want to be when you grow up? And I told her, and she told me, and what did I wind up doing?
Yep.
Now, I'm like 11, 12 years old. I just never forgot that moment.
Mm. Yeah, and it's those moments that change
now,
your life.
Now, let me go back to my mother. She lived in a nursing home. She was 104. She's about 102. I go in to see her. She's sitting in her chair. I sit down, and she leaned forward and said, I wish I had known. And she didn't have to tell me what she wished she'd known. She kept trying to make me be like my older brother and older sister.
Yeah.
It wasn't her fault. They just didn't know back then. But that was so satisfying a year or so before she died to say, I wish I'd known. We didn't do this right. Parents who are listening to this, you can do it right. But don't make excuses. Find out what they want to do. Guide them that way. Make it easy for them to go there. And I think it's going to take care of itself.
Yeah. But I think it made you who you are.
Yeah, and I didn't like who I was for a long time. But if I had to go through that to do what I did the last 30 or 40 years of my life, I'd do it again.
Yeah.
It was awesome.
Yeah. I mean, you've been such – I mean, it's been so fun learning about you. And you just – you've inspired me, and it's just – thank you for just the wisdom that I've learned about you and just through things that
I've
you've
never been accused of disparting wisdom to anybody, but I want a recording of this.
Yeah, well.
It's wit and wisdom.
We'll just cut that little part out. But, I mean, it really is just fascinating knowing, and it really, I think, hopefully this gives people hope that no matter how you struggle or no matter what you feel like you don't get or don't have, that you can still be successful, and it is up to you.
Think about this. A guy wins the mile race in track, but he can't beat the guy that does the 100-yard dash. It's a different skill set.
Yeah.
So get in the right race. Find your right race, and you'll run it, and you'll be a winner.
Yep.
You get into the wrong race. You try to go run the mile relay when your talent is you're a 100-yard dash guy. You're not going to do well. You got to find out what lane you should be in, and when you get there, you'll know it.
Yeah,
you'll know it.
And just to never give up.
Yeah, it took me 30 years to get there. Although I was getting closer every time I did something.
But you learn things along the way.
Thank God I was funnier. I don't know what I'd be doing.
Right. Any last wisdom
any parting thoughts?
How many more do you need?
Yeah, I don't think we need. I think we've got plenty.
But I can, this, like, I just this, love this. I know.
It's a wrap. Yep,
that's
it's
a wrap. Hit that slate.
But thank you for joining us. Yeah. It's been such a pleasure. A